to it. It's Friday. Damn it, it's Friday. It's the 14th day of June 2019. I'm Derek Hunter. I'm your host. This is the Daily Caller Podcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for sharing all that good stuff. Thank you for all the emails and everything. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. I just want to say thank you. There's a lot of kind words coming in of late. This week in particular, I don't know what I did differently that makes people want to say nice things to me. And I don't really acknowledge them when I write back. I address everything else in there. I'm horrible at receiving compliments. I'm really good at receiving foot massages. I'm probably one of the best in the world at receiving foot massages. Honestly, if there were a competition, I would definitely podium. But when it comes to receiving compliments, I'm not good at it. But I do appreciate them. So thank you for that. It's Friday, so that means that there is an interview on the program. And this time is Shannon Bream. We were able to sit down with Shannon Bream on Wednesday for, looks like, about 34 minutes. Very good. And you can also watch the video of the interview at dailycaller.com. But the audio of it will be sandwiched at the end of this program. That means you only get to hear me for 25, 26 minutes today. So lucky you as you head off into the weekend. But Shannon Bream was incredibly gracious, incredibly nice. We had a great conversation about her new book, Finding the Bright Side. And I can announce that she signed, I paid out of my personal funds to get two copies of the book signed, three copies really. One was sent to my wife at her work, which I just snaked and got signed for my collection. But I paid and bought two copies of her book autographed, so you can learn at the end of the program how to enter to win a signed copy of Shannon Bream's book. It was kind of funny because when I was buying her books on Amazon, I searched her name, and the first thing that comes up is her book, obviously. The second thing that came up was signed 8x10 pictures of Shannon Bream, and they're selling for $65. And I said to her off camera and off mic, what's the deal with that? And it was some guy pulling a scam, pretending to be a whole bunch of different people, writing in and requesting a signed photograph and then turning around and selling them. So there's there's scammers everywhere, ladies and gentlemen, everywhere. I suggested that she go on and then offer signed photographs of herself for like a dollar donation to charity and just undercut this guy completely. Cost him, you know, he won't even cover his postage. But I don't know if she's as vindictive as I am, although she did appreciate the idea. Anyway, you get to hear all about Shannon Bream's life story. Far as I know, the only person to be missed two different states. Two different pageants, but she was Miss Virginia and Miss Florida USA, which is a pretty good run, and how she kind of got involved in that, it's kind of amazing and funny. I make a lot of jokes during the program, and she laughed politely, probably hated them, but that's beside the point. She laughed politely. You'll hear it all coming up, but I want to get to the news of the day before we get to that, because there is a lot of news of the day. The Democratic field. Well, I talked yesterday for a half an hour about the media's reaction to the president saying, why wouldn't I take information from anybody? You know, if somebody's got dirt on my opponent, of course I'm going to take the information. I might call the FBI, but I might not. Who knows? Depends on what the information is. And, of course, the media reaction, the pearl-clutching continued as George Snuffleupagus's interview aired with the president. It's so ridiculous. You would have thought nothing else was going on in the world if you watched CNN. Luckily, nobody watches CNN. CNN was showing clips of MSNBC. They were so desperate to keep talking about this. That's how bad they are. It's amazing to me how much content on cable television, on cable news, is hosts showing clips of other networks' hosts saying something stupid. Honestly, just get over it. I could go through, if I listened to a bunch of political podcasts, I'm sure I could go through and pick out all kinds of stupid things that other people have said and then just say, well, listen to this guy talk about this paranoid person. And people could dissect this show the same way. But there's so much else going on in the world that I don't really want to even acknowledge that other podcasts exist. And I don't even really... I guess when you're starved for content and you're directly competing with each other, because if you're on at 9 o'clock, if you're Rachel Maddow, you're competing directly with Sean Hannity. And if you're Sean Hannity, you're competing directly with Rachel Maddow. But you're not getting much crossover. Nobody's flipping around. Nobody watches both. Nobody watches one and DVRs the other. How about you just talk about the news? Leave the media commentary to people like me. All right. So, yeah, that was funny. I don't feel the need to go into that any deeper. I thought we covered it thoroughly yesterday. But the news in the political world is the Democratic debate is set. The 26th and 27th, or the 27th and 28th, I can't remember which. The two-night event, it's like a made-for-TV movie, two-parter, is all set. Then now we know who is going to make the main stage and who is not going to make the main stage. And it's all the usual suspects if you look at it. It's kind of funny they had these ridiculous qualifications. They couldn't just let everybody up there. They've limited it to 20 people. How sad is that? We can't let everybody up there, only 20. And you think, 20? Isn't that more than enough? Most qualified because they met the threshold of 65,000 unique donors and at least 200 different donors in 20 states and 1% in the polls that they determined are important. But there were some who didn't quite make the cut as far as the number of donors. They got in because they polled well enough. And if you look at it, the big one that made it in sort of through the back door is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. You imagine the stink he would raise if he hadn't made the stage? He would have been whining nonstop. The names that didn't make the stage, that did not make the debate, include Montana Governor Steve Bullock, which he's running around, he's complaining, he's whining, he's going, I'm only being penalized because I didn't get in until like 3 weeks before the debate. Well, then that's just really stupid strategy on your part then, isn't it? You know, if you're not going to announce until just before the debates happen, and you know the criteria going in, it's not like the governor of Montana has national name recognition whatsoever, and you're not going to be able to ramp up 65,000 donors in 3 weeks. Maybe it was your fault. He was saying, he whined, I saw an interview with him, I'm not going to bother playing you the clips, but I saw an interview with him where he's like, I wanted to wait until we were done expanding Medicaid for 100,000 people. And I'm thinking, Montana has a population of like 1 million people. How do you expand Medicaid to 100,000 people? That's 10% of you're bragging that 10% of your population is now suckling the government teat on a health care plan designed for poor people? You're bragging about that? Why isn't it anybody out there bragging about the number of people they've gotten off Medicaid? Not even by cutting qualifications, although they absolutely should, but by saying our economy is so booming that we have 20,000 fewer people on Medicaid because they've gone and gotten jobs and their lives are better. Instead, it's we've expanded welfare to more and more people. That's why I was unable to make the debate stage. Also not making the debate stage was former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. You got to wonder what the hell Alaska was thinking when they ever elected this nut job. He ran in, I think it was 2016. One year he's run a couple of times, I think. He did a weird video where he just stares at a camera, literally for like 3 minutes, and then walks back without ever saying a word. Walks away from the camera, and in the shot, he's standing next to a lake. He picks up a big rock and kind of chucks it into the water and then goes about his business. It was viral. It was viral before it was viral, but he's also like 85 years old, so he's not ever going to make it up there. Florida Mayor Wayne Messam didn't make the stage. He's been in the hunt for a long time, and he could not make the 65,000 donors or 1%. So I think it's kind of time to probably go back to being mayor of your crappy little town. And Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts didn't make it. He's the last one who did not make the debate stage. And it's kind of funny because if you watch Fox News, as I suspect many of you do from time to time, you remember Marie Harf, right? She was a State Department spokeswoman under Obama, big lib. She was all over Fox because she was a Fox News contributor. She left Fox News to go work for the Seth Moulton for President campaign, and he didn't make the debate stage. She could not push him over 1% or 65,000 donors. So I'm not really sure that was the best career move available for her, but she'll be missed or something by somebody, probably. Of course, Joe Biden did make the debate stage, and I want to just share with you a story about why it's so important that Joe Biden be elected president, and why I think everybody, every American, should vote for him. Because as we learned yesterday from Joe Biden, there was no lies and no scandals during the Obama administration. I mean, putting aside all the scandals, though, once you ignore the scandals, you find that there were no scandals in the Obama administration. But I'm not talking about the scandals. I want to talk about the truth-telling during the Obama administration, of which Joe Biden was an integral part. He said yesterday that, let's just listen to Joe again, just for the hell of it.
Now, I was most proud of, for 8 years, there wasn't one single hint of a scandal or a lie.
For 8 years, there was not one single hint of a scandal or a lie, and the barking seals in the audience all start applauding as the mackerel are being thrown into their mouths. So we know, we've established from his own word, that Joe Biden is a truth teller. He can't help it, really. He's like Jim Carrey in Liar Liar. He's compelled to speak the truth. And with that in mind, that is why I think everybody should vote for Joe Biden. Because, well, The Hill newspaper reports, 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful Joe Biden said Tuesday that his administration would focus on curing cancer should he win office next year. Quote, I've worked so hard in my career that I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes America. We're going to cure cancer. End quote, Biden said to applause Tuesday at a campaign event in Iowa. So, Joe Biden, if elected president, is going to cure cancer. You have to vote for him. That's just science. My question, though, to Joe is, if you lose, are you going to share your secret cure for cancer that you have with people? Or are you just being a disgusting opportunist, holding out hope to people whose family members are going through the fight for their lives and scared shitless, quite frankly? Are you going to keep that to yourself? Do you have this? This reminds me of, was it 2004 when John Kerry was running? And he basically said, no, wait. It was 2004, but it was John Kerry's running mate, John Edwards. A couple of Johns. You can take that however you want. There's so many possibilities, and all are accurate to one degree or another. When John Edwards was running for vice president in 2004, he made a promise. He said this on the campaign trail, quote, Christopher Reeves, remember Christopher Reeves, Superman, Christopher Reeves just passed away, and America just lost a great champion for this cause, somebody who was a powerful voice for the need to do stem cell research and change the lives of people like him who have gone through a tragedy. Well, Edwards continued, if we do the work that we can do in this country, the work that we will do when John Kerry is president, people like Christopher Reeves are going to walk, get up out of that wheelchair, and walk again. End quote. So, of course, the two Johns lost in 2014, and they kept this miracle cure for paralysis to themselves, which really strikes me as a dick move. You know, John Edwards was, of course, unavailable for comment. He was off with his baby mama, or whatever the hell he does, cheating on his cancer-ridden wife. See, you know, John Edwards didn't want to cure cancer because he knew it was going to make him single. So now you've got Democrats again promising the sun, the moon, and the stars. Joe Biden says he will cure cancer if he's elected president. Otherwise, he says, to hell with you. By the way, remember the debate over stem cell research and all the promises that were made about that, and not just that that Christopher Reeves would be able to walk again, even though he had passed away, which, why would you want to create a zombie Christopher Reeves? But hey, you know, John Edwards has his own kink. What happened to all those, where are all those cures we were promised? We got stem cell research. Barack Obama came in, opened the floodgates, signed all the executive orders, made everything, you know, kosher and ready to go. We were promised everything under the sun, and we got nothing. Remember that? Remember all those promises? Have you seen them? Adult stem cells, those have actually led to treatments and cures. But fetal stem cells from abortions, not so much. Kind of weird. Democrats, of course, don't really care. They do really have a fetish for abortion, and so they're aroused at the prospect of being able to, I mean, I guess Planned Parenthood's happy. That gives them something else they can sell on the black market. Well, not really on the black market, because the government allows it, but yeah, I just wanted to let you know that you have to vote for Joe Biden, because he will cure cancer, and otherwise he won't. If you don't vote Joe Biden, he promises that he will not cure cancer. And he doesn't explicitly say that, but we all know what he means. And John Edwards, he kept his word. He kept the cure for paralysis to himself when John Kerry lost. So there's no reason to think that Joe Biden would pony up the cure for cancer if he loses. So it's conditional love, very conditional love that he has for the American people. Speaking of conditional love, I want to just give you a quick reminder about Alan Dershowitz. I know that he's wildly popular right now with conservatives. He's selling a ton of books in support of not impeaching Donald Trump. Does that make sense? In opposition to impeaching Donald Trump, probably would have been a better way to say that. But he's been all over Fox News. He's a constant presence there. He's got his own skeletons in his closet. He's involved in the Jeffrey Epstein mess with the underage girls. He's been accused of some horrible things, but he's never going to be asked about those horrible things as long as he keeps saying nice things and about the president and avoids CNN and MSNBC because they'll ask him about it deliberately because he says nice things about the president. Well, he was on XM Sirius or Sirius XM Radio yesterday with Dan Abrams, who is the ABC News chief legal correspondent, I think. I don't know what the hell he is, but he's something to do with ABC News. He also founded the website Mediaite. And just as a reminder, just as people, because sooner or later this is going to become an issue, I want you to remember that Alan Dershowitz is a massive lib. He's a massive liberal. He just happens to be a principled liberal who looks at the law in a dispassionate way and doesn't think, well, how can I spin this to my particular point of view or advantage? He just tells you what he thinks on issues. And right now, on the issue of impeachment and obstruction of justice and everything Democrats are doing, he is disgusted by it from a constitutional standpoint. Still, at his heart, he is a big lib. So I just want to play this clip from the interview to remind you that while he is saying things you like now, he is not on your team. He is not in the trenches with conservatives on anything else except impeachment. And to his credit, he's there. He's fully there, and he's there based on his deeply held beliefs on the Constitution. But when it comes to the election, that's a little bit different.
Look, I'm going to judge him when I vote on the totality of his conduct, the totality of his accomplishments, and I'm going to make a judgment based on that. But I think to conflate is wrong with what's illegal or impeachable raises questions.
I completely agree with you. But you're not going to vote for Donald Trump, are you?
It depends who runs against him. If Bernie Sanders is nominated, that would present a real dilemma for me. I don't think under any circumstances I could vote for a man who went to England and campaigned for a bigot and anti-Semite like Jeremy Corbyn. I don't think I can do it. I couldn't pull that lever.
And if the candidate is Joe Biden?
I'm a strong supporter of Joe Biden. I like Joe Biden. I've liked him for a long time, and I could enthusiastically support Joe Biden.
Over Donald Trump.
Over Donald Trump, yeah.
Okay.
So if and when Joe Biden wins the Democratic Party nomination, you will see Alan Dershowitz endorse him, come out in support of him. Then you'll probably see him stop appearing on Fox and start appearing again on CNN and MSNBC. It will ebb and flow like that. I just don't want you to be blindsided by it. Never forget who these people are. Just because they're with you on one thing doesn't mean they're actually with you. And I see him, he's selling a ton of books. He's saying all the right things. He's getting all the right attention. And everybody loves him. And they cite him here and they cite him there. And I sound like Dr. Seuss because they cite him everywhere. But he is not on your team. He is on his own team. He's true to himself. And you got to give him credit for that. I much prefer that to the people who pretend to be one thing and actually are something else. But just wanted to give you that little friendly reminder, because when it does happen, and it will happen, you don't want you to be blindsided by it. Speaking of being blindsided by it, there is a new member of the Denver City Council. This is this is the future of the Democratic Party. This is where they are heading. Not that long ago, in your lifetime, in my lifetime, this person would have been relegated to the fringe and been laughed at and dismissed. Instead, Democrats are electing these people. Daily Caller News Foundation reports Candy Cedebaca, I don't know how the hell, C-D-E-B-A-C-A, but the B is capitalized in the middle of the name, so who the hell knows? She beat incumbent Albus Brooks, is Dumbledore's brother, what the hell, in a runoff race for Denver City Council on June 4th, running on a platform to bring about communal ownership of land, labor, and resources, quote, by any means necessary. Now, she's a mildly attractive woman who is absolutely insane. She's 32 years old. She's a member of the Democratic Socialists Club, AOC's club, all Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, the real leaders of the Democratic Party. This is what the Democratic Party is and has become. In a debate a few months ago that went little noticed until she won, she said the following. Keep in mind as you hear this, when she's talking about labor, she's talking about people, because labor doesn't exist unless a human being does it, right? Therefore, she's talking about ownership of people, their labor, by the state, by the collective. Keep that in mind as you listen to her.
I don't believe that our current economic system actually works. Capitalism by design is extractive, and in order to generate profit in a capitalist system, something has to be exploited. That's land, labor, or resources. And I think that we're in late phase capitalism, and we know it doesn't work, and we've got to move into something new. And I believe in community ownership of land, labor, resources, and distribution of those resources. And so whatever that morphs into, I think is what will serve community the best. And I'm excited to usher it in by any means necessary.
She's proud to rush in slavery and full ownership of individuals by the state by any means necessary. She's describing communism there, and there are at least 50 million dead people in Russia and another 50 million dead people in China who really are collectively rolling over in their graves. If there are any earthquakes anywhere on the planet, there's really a lot of them were burned up. There's not a lot of graves to roll over, and so that might spare us from the total effects of the earthquake that they would otherwise cause. But yes, this is the face of the Democratic Party. This is the future of the Democratic Party if the Democratic Party wins. If the American people do not reject this, this is where the country is headed. So be ready for it. By any means necessary. That means you're on board or you're not on board. The difference between liberals and conservatives is conservatives, for the most part, just want to leave people alone. Liberals want to use the power of government to force you to do something, force you to do what they want to do. That's incredibly, incredibly dangerous and oppressive, and dare I say, anti-American. I know that gets thrown around a lot, but it's actually true. in this case. Speaking of the grandfather, the daddy, the godfather of forcing people to do things they don't want to do, lastly, I want to play this little clip from Bernie Sanders, who really seems to believe that you are out there just wanting, waiting, wishing, hoping that you could pay more in taxes. You desperately want to pay more in income taxes. It's kind of funny. He went on CNN to try and make his case, and he says, well, I want to reach the American people. Why the hell did you go to CNN then? Nobody's watching CNN. But Anderson Cooper had him on anyway, because Anderson Cooper has an hour of television to fill. I also want to remind you that while he's talking about the wealthy in this country, Bernie Sanders is, Anderson Cooper is a Vanderbilt. Just keep that in mind. One of the wealthiest families in the history of this country, the Vanderbilts, right there is the current Vanderbilt. And he's down with oppressing the rich because he knows it's not really about the rich. It's about the wrong people having money. It's not about people having money. The Vanderbilts will be fine. The rich liberals will be fine. They won't, you know, eat them. They'll eat the rich who don't want to conform to their progressive platform. But let's listen to crazy Uncle Bernie tell you that you're just chomping at the bit to pay more in taxes.
You know how the president's going to paint your talk of democratic socialism, besides, you know, Venezuela. Is do enough Americans know what you mean by that and what that actually looks like?
Well, Anderson, that's why I'm on your show tonight.
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Look, what we have to understand, for example, just for example, the United States is the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a right. In many countries in Europe, Germany for one, you go to college and the cost of college is zero. I think in Finland they actually pay you to go to college. In most countries around the world, the level of income and wealth inequality, which in the United States today is worse than at any time since the 1920s, with three families owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, that level of income and wealth inequality is much less severe than it is right here in the United States.
But the taxes in many of those countries are much higher than they are in the individual personal taxes, much higher than they are in the United States.
But I suspect that a lot of people in this country would be delighted to pay more in taxes if they had health, if they had comprehensive health care as a human right.
Just chomping at the bit, man. I am ready to go. Where can I write that big fat check, Bernie? I just want to pay more in taxes to get into a government queue to eventually get to see a doctor. It's going to be wonderful. They're always selling utopia, whether it's by any means necessary or with other people's money when it's really your money. But the left is always selling utopia, yet they've never, ever achieved it anywhere on the planet. In fact, wherever they've tried, they've made things significantly worse. The funny thing about liberty is it's really easy to lose. Really easy to lose. And really tough to get back once you lose it. That's why these people must absolutely positively be crushed in the 2020 election. Just absolutely be decimated in the 2020 election. Even if you don't like Donald Trump, he is so much better than the alternative. Even if you're just a squishy moderate who thinks Donald Trump shouldn't tweet the way he does. Fine. That's absolutely fine. You can think that all you want. But the alternative is this garbage. The alternative is, by any means necessary, we're going to take your property and your labor, meaning yourself, and make you a ward of the state. But don't worry, you'll get comprehensive health care. No, you won't. No, you won't. You'll get what the government is willing to give you. And that's it. When the government is your only option, who are you going to complain to? Who are you going to appeal to? I'll take my business elsewhere. There is no elsewhere. You're screwed once they get their claws into you, so don't let them. All right, we are out of time right there. I got a couple of emails like, hey, didn't mention anything about the NHL, about the St. Louis Blues winning. I didn't talk about it leading up to it much because it always seems like whenever I openly root for a team, they lose. I just didn't want Boston to... I wanted the Blues to win because they'd never won a Stanley Cup. And I wanted Boston to lose because New England sports fans are horrible people. And I mean, I mean that as somebody who has a lot of friends who are New England sports fans, and I'm going golfing today again with my friend Brian, who is from Boston, who is very depressed about the way that the Bruins lost. He's miserable, but he would have been more insufferable had they won. So good on the Blues. I thought their goalie played an amazing series. And I will say, one of the defensemen, the Krupp, I think his name is, for the Bruins, my brother is friends with his dad. And if they'd won, there was likely going to be a party back in Michigan with the Stanley Cup. But I would have crashed if my brother had given, I told him to give me a heads up when it happened. I had a vested interest in Boston winning because I would have been able to hoist the cup, and I would love to hoist the cup. But I couldn't root for New England sports fan. I couldn't root for a Boston team, couldn't root for a New England team. And I wanted the Blues to win because they'd never won. If it can't be the Wings, I'd rather the team that hasn't won or hasn't won in a long time win. And that happened. So congratulations to them. There you go. That is it for this week. The Shannon Bream interview is coming up immediately following the end of this ramble. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Shoot me an email, Derek@dailycaller.com. Otherwise, be back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller Podcast, the Friday video edition. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. And if you're looking at me, I'm sorry if you're just about to eat, but don't worry, we're going to take care of that, because sitting to my right is the one and only Shannon Bream, host of Fox News at Night and host of Finding the Bright Side, The Art of Chasing What Matters. New book. First of all, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I want to get right into it because I know you're very busy and you're taking time out of your schedule to get here. But this is a personal story of yourself. As somebody who's written a book, I know that it's cathartic. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a very personal autobiography where you go into some pretty significant mm-hmm. things that happened to you in your life, before you start, is there hesitance? You sit there and you go, how honest do I want to be? Because everybody's the hero of their own story.
Right.
And not many people want to show the warts and all, but you have to. You have to be that honest if you're going to do it. So what was the thought process before you even started?
Yeah. I thought, because of the way that it was kind of pitched to me to do this book, that it would be, a lot of my weird, quirky stories, some behind the scenes things of covering the president or being at Fox or how things work. And I thought, well, people always kind of like those peek behind the curtain kind of things. But I also really wanted to feature my faith. And I thought, you know what, if I'm going to do that, then I've got to be honest about the really bad things in my life as well as the good, because people see you on Instagram or TV or whatever, it's mm-hmm. all the best parts of your life. And right. I thought, if I'm going to be really vulnerable and hope to encourage other people, I'm going to have to tell them about some mistakes I've made and tough things that have happened too.
But was there fear in doing that? Because you have an image, whether it's cultivated or not, there's an image when you're on television that people project on you for the most mm-hmm. part. And you're voluntarily pulling that mm-hmm. back.
Yeah. There were a couple chapters that were really hard that I really hesitated over because they were so personal and talking about, in one case, getting to a really, really dark place myself where mm-hmm. I really was not sure that my life was worth living.
Well, I want to get into that. And I don't want to be Barbara Walters. I don't want to make you cry. But no, if you do, it'd be ratings gold.
Yes. Anything for Derek.
The thing you're talking about there is you have a condition, chronic pain. That you would never know. You're so damn happy all the time. I mean that as a compliment. As somebody who's very cynical, I'm envious of that gene. But there's a deeper meaning behind this. There's a deeper truth behind that where you contemplated suicide at one point. You had a conversation with yourself mm-hmm. kind of justifying that, well, everybody would understand. Mm-hmm. Talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that, because it's not the image that maybe not you didn't cultivate, but that is there of you.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the hardest stories to tell, and the one that gave me a lot of pause about, do I want to put this out there? But I thought, most people do see me as very sunny, and I think that's kind of my default setting. But you never know what other people...
You always find the bright side.
You can find the bright side. but I think that we never know what other people are struggling with, and I thought it was important to be honest about that. But I'd had a chronic condition with my corneas, where they were tearing all the time. If you've ever scratched the surface of your eye, you know what that's like, and it was becoming an everyday thing for me. And it took almost 2 years until I found the right specialist, got diagnosed properly. But during that time, I was exhausted, because it was primarily happening when I was sleeping. So I couldn't sleep more than an hour or two at a time. Oof. And I was in excruciating pain probably 90% of the time. And you do that for a couple of years. And I think about people who live with chronic pain. It made me much more empathetic. Mm-hmm. But it also took me to a really dark place where I did think, when I heard other people talking about living with this condition, that they couldn't survive it. And I thought, yeah, I see no purpose in going on like this. I would just like to go to sleep and not wake up.
How did you survive it? Your faith was obviously part of it, but if you got to the point where you were justifying it, that you needed something a little bit more, was it?
I did. But I sat down with my husband because there was enough of that conversation with myself about what would I do? How would my family react? How would this, would they understand? Would they be so hurt? They love me. They understand this hell I'm living in. Would they be okay with this? And it kind of startled me enough to say, like, no one's going to be okay with this if you do this. And I just went to him. He was the only person who knew how bad it was, but he didn't know how bad that I was now having those conversations with myself. And I just put it out there for him, like, I just need a lifeline. I don't know how I can get through another day of this, another night of this. And he is my biggest support and said, like, listen, not that we're millionaires, but we'll clean out everything we have. We'll travel the world. We'll find a doctor. We're going to get you help. And in the meantime, you know, I'm going to be with you every night through this, every day through this, and we're going to hang in this together.
I don't want to just dwell on the bad, but I kind of want to go back and forth between those things. And let's start with your early life in Florida. You were not projected to be a television news host. You were not, it wasn't an option for you. Your father was a Marine and a cop, right?
Yes.
So I imagine when boys started coming around, they started running away pretty quickly too, because there's some sergeant officer Marine answering the door.
Well, and two, my parents divorced when I was young. So I went back and forth between my parents, but even my stepdad, who is amazing, very tough cookie. He's former Navy and he has an extensive gun collection, which as I talk about in the book, he was always cleaning when any boy would come over, but it's not like they were beating down my door. I was a nerd, and my parents
always
were
hear
so,
every supermodel. No, like true. I was a nerd in high school. Like, Paris modeling.
Well, this is why my mom says she should have included pictures. She was really mad because she takes pictures of every second of my life, and then there are none in the book, and she's furious. Like, what? When's
that's
my
second,
time to shine?
I
don't know about that. Finding the dark side. That'll be the next one. The Coke bottle glasses, the braces, the whole thing, and not allowed to dance, not allowed to listen to secular music, not allowed to hang out with boys.
Your mom had a sign.
Meanest mom in the world. And she loved it. I say that about her. And I'm like, that's not disparaging her. She bought herself a plaque and she put it up in the kitchen. Meanest mom in the world. So that's how I grew up.
So when you get a chance to go away to college, a different world for you. What was your first thought? Were you afraid to get outside this protective bubble, or were you thinking, you know, looking forward to it?
I was super excited. Because I'd had really no autonomy and I'm a super independent person. I came out of the womb that way. My parents will tell you, like, the only rebellious streak I had with them was constantly pushing the borders of, like, I can do this myself. I don't need help. I want to do my own thing. I was the youngest kid in my class, you know, 16. I was a senior in high school, went off to college at 17, and I just wanted to experience the world. Now, I went to a conservative college because that's what mom and dad wanted me to do. But it's a joke that, like, my husband, when he got there, he thought it was the end of the world because there's curfew. There's all these, you know, rules and regulations. Liberty University. He was like on the verge of getting kicked out all the time. Me, I was like, okay, there is a curfew, but it's midnight. So between when I get out and get out of class until midnight, I can do whatever I want. It felt like freedom to me. We had two totally different reactions to the rules.
But you met your husband there. Mm-hmm. You also became Miss Virginia. Mm-hmm. How did this bookish nerd with Coke bottle glasses who didn't get to go out past the street lights coming on get convinced to enter the Miss Virginia pageant?
I saw a poster for the local pageant on campus at school, and I went to the informational meeting and I found out, and I knew about Miss America. I knew that there were scholarships and all these kinds of things that could, you know, help me out because I didn't come from money. My family is very hardworking, all about education and faith and doing the right things, but, you know, we weren't super connected or wealthy or any of that stuff. So when I found out about this scholarship money, my parents were like, okay, maybe that is a great idea. Maybe you should do this. So I decided to give it a go, but I think I talk about in the book how when I showed up for the meeting, people are like, why are you here? Like, really, what are you doing here? And I just sort of had, you know, to dive right into it and to kind of let the experts help me out with, like, figuring out hair and makeup and wardrobe. I borrowed clothes.
I mean, didn't know how to do any of that.
No.
Stuff. And you won. So everybody had to hate you.
Okay. But the very first pageant I did, I totally embarrassed myself. But the next one I did win that, went on to win Miss Virginia and ended up at Miss America in the finals. So I had a lot of help.
And then you go to law school in Florida. Mm-hmm. Married at that time?
My very last semester, my dad had threatened me, you're not getting married before you get either a medical degree or your JD. So don't talk to me about that. But he caved and let me get married my last semester of law school.
I guess you can see, when you can see the finish
line. Right. He's like, she's going to do it. You can exhale. It's going to be okay. Bit.
And then you decide, I don't know if anybody's ever won Miss two different states. I mean, different pageants, mm-hmm. Miss USA mm-hmm. and Miss America. Mm-hmm. But why did you then go, was it because, hey, I can pay for law school if
yeah,
I win some money?
That was part of it. And because I didn't do the freshman 15 when I went to college. But when I went to law school that first year, I mean, it was me and Ben and Jerry's in the books all the time. And I packed on at least 15 or 20 pounds my first year of law school. I was miserable just trying to survive.
Well, the first year of law school is designed to get people to drop out, isn't
it? A lot of people in class left. Yes, it was terrible. But there was something about it that I felt like I kind of sort of lost myself. I sort of fell apart that first year. And I thought, all right, I've been approached about the Miss USA thing, the Miss Florida USA, and I thought that'd be a way to kind of get myself, I think, back on track, healthy, making better decisions, kind of something aside from the books to keep me going.
So everybody who's ever entered a pageant, I don't know how many people are listening to this, but are going to be angry. You entered on a lark in Virginia and you won, and then you go to Florida like, I just want to lose some weight, so I'll enter a pageant.
I did.
And then you win.
Well, I think that everything has to line up right for you. I mean, it was just, you know.
But it didn't fall into your lap. You actually worked at these
Yeah,
things.
You do. You have to work at it, especially when I was doing Miss America, which has the talent competition, and I was doing Chopin for that. Mm. I was a pretty serious pianist growing up, but that was nerve-wracking to me. I mean, I have terrible stage fright. And so, I mean, that was like 5 hours a day of practice when I was getting ready for Miss America. So there is a lot of work that goes into it. Miss USA, you just have to basically not eat unless you're naturally skinny. I mean, I was hungry for a couple of years there.
Then you graduate law school, malnutrition and all. Mm-hmm. Go into law, which is pleases your father. That mm-hmm. was the demand. Then a funny thing happened. You kind of hated it. Mm-hmm. You're good at it, but you hated it. Mm-hmm. Why did you? I know so many people, especially in Washington, D.C., who have their JDs, who never practiced law, who decide the second year of law school, I never want to do this for a living. Mm-hmm. You probably decided sometime around then, but your father's mm-hmm. like, you're going to do this.
Yeah.
How do you get the gumption to leave?
Yeah.
Knowing that you got the permission, the blessing of your father. Your father must have been over the moon that you were a lawyer.
He loved that I was a lawyer because he knew I had a steady income to take care of myself and had a good foundation for life. And I think that's what he was all about, wanting to make sure that I could take care of myself and, mm-hmm. and have a good start in life. He was the last person I told that I was going to leave because I was so scared as a grown woman at 30 to tell my dad, okay, I'm ditching that entire career and
for
going into another.
A low-paying, no-paying internship at a local TV station mm-hmm. that you have to actually pay to get because you had to pay.
Right, I had to take college classes.
That you were out of college. You had to go find somebody who's willing to put you on the roster.
Yeah.
So you could get
this.
It's
totally weird. But I would go out on nights and weekends with anybody who would let me go. Any photographer, reporter was kind enough. And there were people who were really great who helped me out because I didn't know what I was doing. But I was so anxious to learn. I'm just a news junkie. And I just wanted to be in that atmosphere. But I knew I had a lot to learn. So it was hard when I was working in local news because my dad lived in Florida and he never saw me. So mm-hmm. I think for 10 years, he thinks I was making it up. I had no job anywhere until I got to Fox years later where he could turn on his TV and watch me. And then he was like, okay, she really has a job, and she's using her law background, and I'm proud of her.
Well, you started off as the intern, and then you got a job on the overnight shift, mm-hmm. the dead shift, in mm-hmm. case a train derailed at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You were there to answer the call.
Right.
I can't remember her name, but you talk about in the book a woman who was incredible as far as taking you on, mm-hmm. giving you the advice. Talk a little mm-hmm. bit about her and the importance of mentorship and what difference that person made to you.
Yeah, there were a lot of people in the newsroom who were like, listen, this is Tampa. This is a top 15 TV market as far as, ranking the sizes of them. And this is not where you start. And listen, I was doing behind the scenes, working the prompter, making coffee, doing that stuff. But they did start letting me go out. If everyone else has broken legs and there's news and no one can go, you can go.
You glue lead everybody you went through.
You can go. That's the only way you're going. But Elaine Cajano, she hosted the vice presidential debate last time around. Mm. I mean, she's really come through the business and so well respected. She was one of those people who reached out to me and said, listen, I don't care how you got here. You obviously care about this and you're going to work hard. So she literally would give me sheets like she had from school, from undergrad, how you pursue a story, how you write a story, the structure. I mean, she gave me so much help. She'd let me go with her and shadow with her. And she was always really, really kind to me. And I would work with her and another photographer who I tried to buy him dinner one night when we went out. And he said, nope, I don't want anything from you. I just want when somebody comes to you and wants to shadow you one day when you make it and wants help, I want you to pay it forward and take care of those people. And it was great advice.
It really is. And you had this drive. Your second boss didn't think you had the talent.
Or any talent.
I was being a little bit nice. I was finding the bright side. But talk about that, because everybody has a moment in their life where somebody looks at them and says, are you sure this is what you want to do? Mm-hmm. Basically in a polite way, inviting you to find something else to do you might be better suited for.
Right.
But you didn't get discouraged. A lot of people would go away with their tail between their legs. When your boss fires you, telling you, you got no business being, you shouldn't even be watching TV news, let alone
being on it. Yeah.
How do you take that and how do you recover from that?
Well, he told me I was the worst person he'd ever seen on TV and I would never make it in the business.
What was he trying to say, do you think?
You stink, Brame. You're awful. Basically what it boiled down to. Every radio and TV studio has these soundproof edit bays, and I literally locked myself in one and started crying and just called, you know, two or three people closest to me, my husband, my agent who I just signed with, and I'm thinking she's going to want to fire me now. And just kind of said what have I done? I've blown up my legal career to come do this. I think I'm in the right space. I think this is where I have a passion and where God has directed me to go. And so how could I be wrong about this? But it did make me think, okay, you might be terrible. You have a lot to learn. There's plenty of room for improvement. It took months and months and months before I even got another call back for another job. So there was a lot of humility gained through that process. And it taught me a lot of lessons that I think sometimes the hardest ones, it's the only way you learn them.
Your faith, where does it come from?
I grew up in a Christian household, and it was just always part of our life. It wasn't like, oh, on Sundays we go do this. It was literally, we pray about everything. If we have a need, we had a tough time when I was growing up, especially when it was just my mom and I. And there was a lot of struggle, but she was always optimistic and like, hey, God has a plan in this. He's not going to let you go without food. We're always going to be okay. There's going to be somewhere we can go. And we would pray about big things and little things. I mean, it was just part of our daily conversation. And, you know, for me, it became personal later in life when I was older and able to understand the concepts of the faith and accept it for myself. And so it's kind of just always been there for me.
Ever question it?
Yes. And I think that my belief is that God understands we're human beings and we're going to have doubts about him.
Fault.
He knows, any thinking human being is going to have questions about, well, this doesn't make sense to me, or why would he allow this to happen? And the really tough questions that you have. So I definitely have gone through that in my life and had times where I would say, you know, I would be away from my faith because I would say some of these things I just can't make sense out of. Mm-hmm. But I always kept coming back, and I feel like God was always drawing me back to say, listen, there is purpose in this, and there's purpose in the tough times and the pain, things you don't understand now, one day you will understand. And, I've just always been very comforted and kind of feel like there's an anchor and a root in my faith for the rest of crazy life.
So you get fired. You're told you're the worst ever. Then you find yourself in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And you find yourself across from Brit Hume. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you get into a room with Brit Hume. I once emailed him when I was in college, kind of a snarky email, just guessed at what his email was. And it was like, you ripped me off, because his little kicker at the end took a joke from a column that I had written.
Oh, okay.
He didn't read it. It was in my crummy college newspaper, but I just decided to send it. And he writes back, sir, I promise you, I did not do that. I'm like, no, I was only kidding. I'm sorry.
He's a gentleman.
I have met him several times since then, and he was incredibly nice. But it was a moment, a life-changing moment for you that you didn't really have anything to do with. You almost ruined it, quite frankly.
I know, and on multiple levels. My husband represents professional speakers, and at the time he was working for an agency that had booked Brit for a breakfast morning speech over at the Hinckley Hilton here in Washington, as we call it. And so I had anchored the late night news the night before because I was working as a local news anchor here in Washington. It had been pushed back by a sporting event because you always go on later, whether it's football or NASCAR, whatever it is, it just pushes back everything. So I'd only gotten a couple hours of sleep, and my husband was like, you got to go with me in the morning. I'd try to get my tape in over at Fox. They get so many people, and they weren't interested. He said, you got to get up and go with me to this Brit thing. And so I was like, I know I'm going to be exhausted. I don't want to do it. He wakes me up the next morning. I look in the mirror. I have a gigantic zit on my face that has magically appeared overnight. And I'm like, this is going to be the worst first impression ever. I don't want to do this. I'm exhausted. I look terrible. Husband's like, you're going. So he talks me into it, and we go, and the program's running behind. So now Britt is trapped in the green room with these two weirdos, Sheldon and Shannon Bream. So while we're in there, Sheldon at one point says, now, Britt, I don't know if you recognize my wife. She's a local news anchor here. And says, oh, Britt, oh, that's very nice. That's great. What do you want to do? And I said, just getting all my gumption up, I want to come work for you at Fox News. And he's sort of like, yeah, I get that all the time. I'm not sure people understand exactly what we do.
Kind that's of a pat so on the nice head. Here's of a lollipop. You.
Right.
That's nice.
He gives me, he writes down his mailing address and says, well, send your little DVD thing over, whatever. Maybe I can give you some career advice. I'm totally embarrassed, but glad I put myself out there. I leave the room to walk around the venue a little bit. The guys are still talking. And he says to my husband, does she like politics? And my husband says, yeah, when she was in law school at Florida State, she worked in the Florida House of Representatives. He said, law school, did she finish? And my husband's like, yeah, she graduated with honors. And Britt literally says to him, do you think she'd want to cover the Supreme Court for Fox News? After I've been kind
You've
of politely blown
off,
I walked out. I walk back in the room not knowing any of this conversation. And Britt says to me, when can you start? And I'm like, what happened? Forget the agent. I should be giving my husband the cut of whatever's happening here. But he said, you know, at that point, he needed to replace Megyn Kelly, was going off to do a morning show with Bill Hemmer in New York. And he didn't want to interview anybody for the position that wasn't a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know that about me. So as soon as he found that out, it changed the whole calculus. And I think there was a little divine intervention. I got to give my husband a lot of credit for making me get up and go to that meeting with Britt. And it took several months and some other, you know, challenges along the way. But there,
if you had stayed in that room, you probably wouldn't have the job.
Where would I? You wouldn't be interviewing me right now. We wouldn't know each other. Who knows
what
would
be
happening?
I'd be sleeping right now.
Would you?
No,
me
no,
too.
Maybe not. I'd probably be changing a diaper. But that's beside the point. But it really, it is, it's luck and being prepared when luck presents itself. Mm-hmm. And talk about your career from there, because it has, obviously you're hosting your own show. You're not standing on the steps of sweating to death in the middle of summer.
Oh, I still do
heat.
That. I do
I know
that.
You do, but and
it's not
the
only
video,
thing I do,
the
though.
Footage of you, you have a nice stride when you're running out because there's that one picture of you and then your interns running.
And now my assistant, Anna, a Division I volleyball player, very competitive athlete. And I knew that she
was
would
she
be
not
good.
The fastest last
yes,
year?
Yes, she kicked a lot
of
booties out there. You know, they still give out the old fashioned paper decisions inside the Supreme Court. And so we all have interns or assistants or people in there. They get it. And then they want to be the first ones to get it to us on the sidewalk where we're all lined up in front of the TV cameras ready to go live. And they will yell at you in the Supreme Court. There are cops everywhere. These are good people. And they're like, no running in the halls. And I, you know,
like
meanwhile,
kind of
all
elementary
of us,
school, go back and walk.
No, and all of us are saying to them, just run. Don't make eye contact. Just keep moving unless they taser you.
All you got to do is
keep
faster
moving.
Than the cops. And
yeah, and Anna probably is faster than the cops. So she's got a great stride too. And
you posted a video of her last year on Twitter of her running,
she
winning
does
the
it.
Race.
She gets it done. She'll do it again this year.
There should be some kind of trophy that's passed
I know.
Around.
I need to get one made.
So you're things are going along well. Then 2015, I believe it is, you have a health scare.
Mm-hmm.
Again, does it seem like two steps forward, one step back, or I don't know how in depth you posted it on Facebook, the health scare. I don't know how deeply you want to get into it, but if you just talk about how you think, I've got it. I'm where I want to be. And then suddenly fate kind of goes, well, no, you're not. Take this.
Yeah. And I think that at this point in my life, I have enough perspective to know like, okay, those moments are going to come. You're going to have great things and highs and moments, but they're going to be unpredictable, really tough things that come your way too. And I'd gone in for a mammogram and just do that as a routine thing. And I usually am kept afterwards. I have a couple of weird genetic things that they want to keep an eye on me. Mm-hmm. So they keep you sometimes for a secondary screening. Mm-hmm. I'm used to that. But this time they didn't let me go. They said, no, we found something. We actually need to biopsy this time. And that was terrifying because, you know, you're relatively young in your 40s and you think you're healthy and, you know, you get news like that. You don't really know where it's going to go. And I can remember getting that scheduled and going to a dinner with my husband and sitting there. And we were planning a 20th anniversary trip. And I remember I started crying at this dinner thinking, what if I don't go on this 20th anniversary trip? Like, you just have so many questions. I don't know how far advanced this is, what it is. And it's just an excruciating process for so many, millions of women go through this.
They move pretty quickly on this, but it seems like forever. My father was recently diagnosed with lung cancer, but it was very early. He had pneumonia, and they did a chest x-ray, and they said, oh, that's weird. We want to check that out. Mm-hmm. They did it, and they blasted it with radiation and all that. And it all happened 3 weeks or something like that.
And it feels like an eternity.
But the
when
waiting,
you're in the middle of it.
The waiting afterwards.
Yeah, so I had the biopsy, and the worst thing I think is that there's no set time they're going to call you with the results. So your phone does not leave you. But they say, oh, 4 or 5 days. And I just, for 24 hours a day, had that phone with me at all the time, just waiting for it to ring, not knowing when I was going to get this call. And I'm thinking, for people who have kids and different things, that's a horrible thing, because what if you're with your children and you get this terrible bad news and you're trying to hold it together? It's just weird. So I was actually going over to a lunch with Justice Breyer. He is really kind that he hosts several members of the media for a couple of informal lunches, usually in June every year. And I was getting ready to walk out the door to this lunch, and I got the call, and they said, there's something there. You're going to have surgery. We need to get this done. And we can't tell you anymore until we get in there and see what it is and get it out. And I just was sobbing, literally on the side of the street, walking over to the Supreme Court by myself, thinking, this isn't the way that you should get this kind of news. Tried to pull it together. I really remember nothing from the lunch except trying not to cry, because I'm with all my colleagues from the Supreme Court and just trying to act like everything's fine.
The fact that you went is a bit of a minor miracle.
I thought it'd be weird if I didn't show up to the lunch with Justice Breyer. I just thought that would draw more attention, not showing, because it's a really nice thing to be able to have a chat with him. And I thought, all right, I want to put this off until the end of June is over, because that's our big time at the Supreme Court where we get all the opinions back. And went to a meeting with my surgeon and Jennifer Griffin, my colleague, who has been through much worse. Stage 4, triple negative breast cancer.
And she made it.
She is like one of the 10% that has completely recovered. She's such an inspiration. She said, go to my surgeon. So Sheldon, my husband, and I went to the surgeon and I said, can I put this off July or August? And they're like, nope, we're doing this right now. So I really tried to fight against it, but my husband was completely backing her up. Like, no, we're doing this.
I got to work. Let me
go. I know. I want to work.
Well, you were gone for 4 days or something like that.
I know.
Right?
I tried to minimize it. Yeah. I tried to minimize it and get back to work as fast as I could, and had the surgery, had the offending mass removed. And then again, you're waiting for results. You're waiting to find out exactly what it is. And I was so anxious to go back to work, but there were a couple days, listen, you're laid up, you can't go.
Right.
And so my colleague at the time, James Rosen, was covering the court, and he's brilliant and does a fantastic job of whatever he covers. But he noticed I was out on a day that was a big day at the Supreme Court, and so I couldn't lie to him. I mean, right. I could have, but we were close enough friends that I said to him, this is what's happened.
Tell him you were at a Beatles convention and he would have been
jealous.
He
would be so jealous then. He'd be like, no, let's trade places. Love James. So, but as soon as I was able to get back out there, I had an ice pack, TMI, sorry, but in my bra on the incision, because I wanted to go back out there. But I learned a great trick from that now, because when it is 1,000 degrees out there, the Supreme Court, I've learned if you have an ice pack in your bra, you feel pretty good. So now I just might do it for fun. But I was out there and I had my ice pack in my bra. Nobody knows what's happening except for maybe two or three people I work with. And I was just so happy to be
Everything's
there.
Everything's good now?
Everything is good. I mean, I got the results back and there were, you know, some complicating factors, but I'm in good shape. I have constant checks and a great doctor.
We're going to wrap it up here in a couple of minutes, but there are just a couple more things I want to get to. Your husband. So it seems like he's always been your rock.
Mm-hmm.
He had some health issues. And we don't have to go into that if you don't want to, but I want to know, when times are good, you're obviously grateful, and it's really easy to have faith when times are good. Do you find it's not important, but easier to have faith when things are bad, or harder to have faith when things are bad? Because there's a wise me sort of mentality, talk about, because I know that your faith is very important to you.
It's a big
theme in the book.
Yeah.
And you hear this and you think, I've got everything I wanted. Oh, no, you don't. And then, every time it's up there, and there has to come, and I just want to know from a faith standpoint, do you find your faith is stronger in those times or weaker?
It's actually stronger for me when I'm really struggling or in a tough place, because like I said, it's sort of the anchor for me. And to think, you know, sometimes we cover such terrible things that happen to people and tragedies, and I immediately stop and pray for these people. But I think, you know, when you're at the bottom, where do you have to go? I mean, for me, it's comforting that I'm not in control of this universe or of my life or anything else. I mean, I believe that God has a bigger plan, even in the bad stuff. So for me, there literally were times when I couldn't even pray. I mean, I would literally just say, God, please help me. And maybe say that 100 times, God, please help me. Please help me. Like, I couldn't even form words to make a more intelligent prayer, but just knowing that he doesn't care, you know, he's listening. And there were times that was the only lifeline. It was the most solid thing that I had. And verses and stories that I'd grown up with and heard my whole life, they just come alive to you in a different way when you're in the worst places. I mean, there's a story in 2 Corinthians where Paul talks about the thorn in his side that he asked God to take it from him many times. And God said, nope, I'm not going to do it. And then Paul goes on to write about, you know, I learned to be happy in my weakness because that's when I turned out to be the strongest. And those verses really got me through a lot. And that's the way I view it.
One of the things I've always had a problem, I'm a Catholic, so this is a lot of everything that goes along with being a Catholic there. When you have the idea that God has a master plan, which you kind of have to accept because there's you're either in or you're out in the belief of God, then there's the idea of prayer and asking for help and guidance. How do you reconcile, because this is where I get lost, the idea that whatever's going to happen is going to happen because it's already set out there in God's master plan. The first domino has fallen. The rest are going to go down. Then what is the point of the prayer, I guess? Is it, like, that's kind of where I get lost. If it's out of my control, if it's fate and destiny, then it's fate and destiny. If it's up to me, then I can see that. So how do you reconcile those two things?
A couple of things. I remember several years ago, I did a study on prayer, and it talked about how so much of prayer is about changing your own heart or changing your own ability to be able to get through the circumstances. So a lot of my prayers have changed over the years. I will pray for someone that is really struggling. If it's me, if it's a family member, friend, somebody in a health crisis, whatever. I do believe that God listens and that there are all instances.
You can adjust the plan a little, maybe?
Well, he's God. So he can do whatever. But I do think about there are times all through scripture where his people came and prayed and were fervent about things, fasting or whatever it was, and God heard them and was moved by that. So I know those stories are there. But I've also come to view prayer as, give me the equipment I need to get through this. If you're not going to heal me, just like with Paul in 2 Corinthians, because listen, he was a disciple. Like if the God's not going to take away his thorn in the side, maybe he's not going to take mine away either. But I would pray for, give me what I need to get through this. If you're not going to change the circumstances, then change me. So a lot of times prayer is that for me too.
Two last things. What do you want people to know about you after reading Finding the Bright Side?
I mean, I do hope that they find... they see that my faith is the most important thing for me, and it can be an encouragement through the worst parts of life, that I am flawed, that I make mistakes. I talk about that in the book, just so I hope it will encourage other people. Like, nobody's perfect. No one's totally got it together. You don't have to. I don't. But there's still great to be found in life.
And then I have a listener question, because I announced that you were coming, and I thought this was a pretty good one. This is Andrew Bellow. He says, how do you deal with and or respond to the stigma being perpetrated by the left that women on Fox are nothing more than a bunch of attractive blonde bimbos who mindlessly push Rupert Murdoch's propaganda? Mm-hmm. We see that mostly in print, but we see that all the time in the media. You're obviously educated. You graduated high school at 17, or in college at 17, graduated high school at 16. They don't do that to dummies unless you're a troublemaker and said, just get out of here, here's your diploma. And then you hear these people who claim to be very progressive, who put forth, equal pay and feminism and all of that. And then they turn and attack your colleagues and you. How does that resonate with you?
I honestly don't take it very personally, because I'll invite people, if they want to say it to my face, great, let's have a conversation. And I'll say, do you watch our show at 11? Do you watch Brett at 6 or Martha at 7? I mean, watch our news product. And we do have a very, bright dividing line between our opinion division, which is loads of fun and has millions of followers. But the news division is on a different mission. And, Anna and I, my assistant, were actually getting mani-pedis. And there was a guy in there. And when he found out that we worked at Fox and we were these women, he was like, how could you possibly work there? It's a terrible place and it's all propaganda. And I was like, will you watch us at 11 for a week? Just watch us at 11. And I think if you engage with people personally and say, like, you can't just throw this big stereotype about people. We are educated. We have our own viewpoints. It's possible to do a straight news show where we say good things and negative things, whatever's happening with the president. And listen, I get on Twitter like, you're so terrible. Why do you hate the president? You're mean. And the same show I'll get, on Twitter, like, you're clearly taking your talking points directly from the White House. So it's like, there's a lot of projection out there. But I think if people would honestly watch our news programs and then come to me with criticism, that's fair.
They should. I don't let my having been on your show deter
I love when you're
from
on our
watching
show.
The show. That's not true at all. She didn't recognize me when she got off the elevator.
Yes, I did.
You can't miss
me. I was
like,
Derek.
Thank you very much. The book, Finding the Bright Side, The Art of Chasing What Matters. The author, Shannon Bream, is going to sign these copies for us when we get off air. And you'll have a chance to win one of two of them. One goes into my personal collection, so I win automatically. But all you have to do is email Derek@dailycaller.com. If you've purchased the book, email me a screen capture of your receipt or your Audible thing. Just do a screen capture. You'll be entered twice, so you got that going for you. And now I'm going to ask you to sift through. It's going to be a mess. They're all individually folded. I used to crumble them up to give it volume, but now they don't need need to be volume.
So I need to pick out two?
Two. These are for the Brent Bozell signed books.
All right, here we go.
Week.
So what have we got here?
The winner is
Chris Cummings.
Congratulations, Chris Cummings. A whole bunch of people were just hoping you'd read their name, so hopefully Chris was one of them.
All right, let's see. And then, get one from over here. Dun, dun, dun. Who have we got? Okay. Yasha Levitis.
I'm glad that I always have the guest read it because I have dyslexia on top of it. And I would just been sneeze. Is there an empty set in the middle of this?
Yasha, I love it. And you can email us and tweet us if we're getting your name wrong.
That's congratulations. Correct me. You'll be emailing me to send me your address. Thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on the book. Best of luck. The show is on at 11 o'clock every night.
Come back
watch
soon.
It. It's nice to get some straight news before you go to bed. Wash all that Tucker off of you.
Oh, we love our Tucker. We love him.
There
yes. I've got a full set.
So.
I've got a full set, which I reserve for my dinner parties.
You are a 10-time winner of the quiz?
They even got me a tiara and a sash that says Tucker Spinal Exam.
You got a pile of tiaras and
but
sashes.
Who can say they have a full place setting of Tucker mugs because only the finest when I have a dinner party, these babies come out.
You're saving money on food. Thanks for watching. Thanks for telling a friend. Share it. All that good stuff. And we'll be back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.
But I suspect that a lot of people in this country would be delighted to pay more in taxes.